Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn. Thanks for joining us for episode 13, Betrayal and Regret.
Tonight, we're on the case in Independence, Missouri, a small town just 10 miles west of Kansas City. It was here that the shocking murder of an 18-year-old girl in an isolated cemetery would send police on a hunt for a sadistic killer and leave them wondering just how twisted the truth can be.
It was just before 4 a.m. on October 23rd, 1997. Officer David Epperson was on routine patrol in Independence, Missouri.
I was working the midnight to 8 shift, and I was patrolling my district.
The quiet suburb had been hit by a rash of car thefts, so Epperson was being extra thorough in some of the community's more remote areas. Even the local cemetery.
The main reason I was in the cemetery is because it'd be an easy place to dump a stolen auto. It has no lights and it's really dark and it's secluded.
But as he drove down the cemetery's long, dusty access road, he spotted something far more disturbing than an abandoned vehicle.
I observed a person lying in the roadway, flat on their back.
The policeman slowly made his way to the motionless figure on the grassy hill in front of him.
I didn't know if the person was intoxicated or hurt or what. The first thing I did is I radioed my dispatcher that I had somebody down in the cemetery. Then I exited my patrol vehicle and I attempted to yell for them to try to get their attention. And I got no response, so I approached and I shined my flashlight.
But as he got closer, his flashlight revealed the terrible truth.
It was a young white female. I noticed that she had an apparent gunshot wound.
It was a gut-wrenching sight. It took every ounce of composure for the seasoned officer to lean in and check to see if the girl was still breathing.
I looked to see if her chest or her stomach was rising. I checked her wrist to see if I had a pulse, and I couldn't find one. It was at that point I noticed that her skin was cold to the touch.
The young woman was dead. The officer couldn't believe what he had just stumbled upon.
I'd been to other crime scenes, but I'd never actually walked up on an incident without actually being dispatched there. My first thought was, where's the perpetrator? There had to be somebody out there.
But he didn't see anyone. Once he felt the scene was secure, Epperson rushed back to his car to radio in his report.
I contacted dispatch and had them advise my supervisor and assisting units to respond to the scene.
Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Teresa Crayon.
He described a gaping wound that started at the base of her nose that extended up through up right underneath her eyes.
By daybreak, detectives and crime scene technicians were busy searching the cemetery for clues. The evidence indicated that the victim had been killed very recently.
Crime scene analyst Charles Clausen.
It looked like it was perhaps within a matter of hours.
Whoever had shot the young woman had taken no chances with the murder weapon.
Officer David Epperson.
Based on the wound to her face, it was either a rifle or a shotgun.
It was up close. It was directly in the center of the face that she didn't have a chance to put up her hands, protect herself or anything. She fell right there at the scene and stayed.
The way her body was found, it looked like the gun touched the end of her nose. She had leaned back, which would be a natural reaction if someone put a gun up to your face and touched the end of your nose. And also her hands were out, which would suggest that she must have put her hands up and she was thrown backward.
Investigators believe the victim
had to have seen what was coming.
She looked right at the person who shot her. She was not running away from somebody. The bottom of her shoes, there was no gravel disturbed near there. There was no signs of a struggle whatsoever. None. There was no evidence of sexual assault. Her clothes were completely intact. Her jacket was buttoned up.
Investigators reached a troubling conclusion.
What that tells us is that she knew who did this to her.
But who would want to kill a teenager in a secluded cemetery? The first step in answering that question was to identify the victim.
She had no wallet on her, so she had no identification on her whatsoever.
Detectives canvassed the area for potential witnesses, but they came up empty.
They were not able to find anybody that heard a gunshot.
Police didn't have much to go on. Whoever the killer was had been careful not to leave any evidence behind at the crime scene.
There was no weapon. There were no slugs or shell casings. There wasn't enough there to use to match to anybody that had been at the scene.
It's an outside area. There weren't any really surfaces for good fingerprints, any surfaces for shoe impressions, hairs, fibers, things like that. There's just a limited amount of evidence.
The sinister murder had become a complex mystery. And as the hours wore on, investigators wondered if they'd ever figure out exactly what happened that night. The sun was still rising over the graveyard when detectives got their first break. A missing persons report had just been filed by a man named Bob Witbelsfugen. His teenage daughter, Anastasia, had never come home the night before. When police on the scene heard Bob's description of his daughter, they immediately went to see him. Anastasia's father, Bob Witbelsfugen.
To the front door comes Jackson County Sheriff's Captain Kellogg. I invited him inside, and we sat at the table, and he said, "Did your daughter have a scar on her chin?" And I'm like, "Yeah, she just a little tiny scar she'd gotten when she was like 5 years old." And I think the next words out of his mouth were, "Can you get her dental records?" We think we found her body. She's been shot.
It was the last thing Bob Witbelsfugen expected to hear.
The rest is just a blur. It was hours later that they confirmed that was her.
Now, it was up to Bob to inform the rest of his family that Anastasia was gone.
I can't even piece it all together. Anastasia is my first daughter.
The oldest of five girls, she was someone her younger sisters looked up to.
Anastasia's sister, Francesca Fitzner.
She's very headstrong and independent. She's had a spark and drew a lot of people in.
The popular and responsible young woman had a bright future. She had been planning to go to college that fall.
She was interested in foreign languages and she wanted to see the world. She wanted to explore. So I kind of was expecting her to have some kind of international career.
Detectives asked Bob about his daughter's last known whereabouts. He said that Anastasia had disappeared after meeting up with her 20-year-old boyfriend, Justin Bruton. Bob told police about the last conversation he had had with his daughter.
Late in the afternoon, I talked to her on the phone because I was going to be late coming home from work, and I wanted to know what her plans were. Then she said that she was going out that evening to meet her boyfriend.
But a few hours later, a phone call from Anastasia's boyfriend would leave Bob very concerned, wondering where his daughter was.
I came home late, around 8:30, 9 o'clock. My other daughter, Francesca, told me that Justin called to say that they had an argument.
Justin told Francesca that during the fight, Anastasia got angry and asked him to let her out of the car. At first, Francesca wasn't alarmed.
It seemed just like Anastasia to get upset really fast and get out of the car. Give her a minute or two, let her stomp off, she would always get back in.
But this time, Justin didn't wait for Anastasia to cool down. He had driven off without her. Later, he called to see if she had ever made it home. Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Teresa Crail.
Anastasia's sister said, no, she's not home, and that's a terrible area, and what do you mean you're not with her? I can't believe you did that. If something happens to her, it's your fault.
When Bob heard the story, he couldn't understand why anyone would leave a teenage girl stranded alone in the dark.
It was not particularly a good neighborhood. It was down in some transient area that had a few gas stations and business of adult nature.
As Bob tried to figure out where Anastasia could be, Justin Bruton called again.
Says, is Anastasia there? I said, no, she's not here. I said, Justin, when you take my daughter out, I'm expecting you to watch over her and make sure that she gets home safely. You know you were responsible for bringing her home. And I don't know that he said anything, but I got the sensation that he understood how devastated I was.
Justin seemed equally concerned.
He stated to me directly, he says, if I hear from her, I will call and let you know that she's okay. And I told Justin, if she comes home or if I hear from her, I will call you and let you know that she's okay.
But as time passed with no sign of Anastasia, her dad couldn't stay home any longer. Bob got into his car and began to search for his daughter.
It was before 10 o'clock. I pulled into the gas station just past the traffic light where she would have gotten out. And I asked the attendant whether they had seen Anastasia.
But no one Bob spoke with that night had seen his missing teen. Distraught, Bob decided to report his daughter's disappearance to authorities.
I found the first picture of Anastasia I could find on the dresser and took that with me to the police station. And she's, you know, confirmed missing by the person who left her abandoned at the location. I'd like for one of your officers to meet me there so that we can discuss what procedure to follow to recover her or to investigate her disappearance.
While Anastasia's father couldn't help fearing the worst, he tried to remain hopeful.
I tried to stay optimistic. I hope and pray that she's okay.
But the next morning, Bob got the news that Anastasia was not okay. A cold-blooded killer had ended her life with a shotgun blast at point-blank range. On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment.
Looking to start the new year with a wardrobe refresh? Quince has you covered with essentials that feel great and look great. They're perfect for layering with plenty of versatile styles that make it easy to reach for them day after day. I love my new cashmere sweater. It's warm and cozy during these cold winter months in the Northeast. And it's not just the sweaters. I gave my producer, Larry, a set of Quince premium bath towels, and he can't stop raving about them. Now you can refresh your wardrobe and home essentials at Quince. Go to quince.com/OTCpod for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/OTCpod to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/OTCpod.
Investigators wanted to speak with Anastasia's boyfriend, Justin, the last person who had seen her alive. They were hoping he might be able to provide the clues they needed to solve the terrifying crime. It was just after 3 in the afternoon when police arrived at Justin's home in Kansas City.
Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Teresa Crayon.
They went to his apartment. He wasn't home. His car wasn't there. The investigators left a card in his door.
But the 20-year-old never contacted police.
They couldn't find him.
It appeared that Justin was on the run, which raised a huge red flag for the investigators working the case.
The obvious suspicion is that he had something to do with Anastasia's death. If you have a boyfriend and girlfriend, and the girlfriend ends up dead, and the boyfriend's missing, he's going to be your suspect at that point.
While the statewide manhunt for Justin continued, Anastasia's sister Francesca gave police a critical piece of information. She said there might be other people who knew what happened on the night of the murder.
Francesca told investigators that she could hear voices in the background when Justin was making that phone call, stating that Anastasia had gotten out of the car. And she was able to tell us that one of those voices was that of Byron Case.
Byron Case was Justin's best friend. Detectives wondered if he had been a witness to whatever happened between Justin and Anastasia. Police brought Byron in for questioning.
Byron told investigators that he and Justin had been together for a bulk of the day, and Anastasia had been calling and wanting to get together with Justin.
Byron said that after he and Justin picked up his girlfriend Kelly, they had made a plan to meet Anastasia.
They picked her up at a Dairy Queen. Anastasia got in the car. She was mad because she had to wait so long for them to come get her. And she was upset with Justin because he had brought Kelly and Byron along. She thought they were going to be alone.
Byron said Anastasia and Justin began arguing almost immediately.
Justin had had some relationship issues. Justin wasn't committing to her the way she wanted him to. In her mind, she wanted this relationship to really work. She wanted to get married and she wanted to live together and have the happily ever after. Justin wasn't so sure he wanted that.
Byron told police the couple's argument over the relationship quickly escalated.
Anastasia asked Justin something like, "Don't you love me anymore?" Justin's response was, "I'm sorry, but I don't."
Byron said the answer put an end to the conversation. And at the next red light, Anastasia put an end to their night together.
Anastasia got very angry and upset. She threw a ring at him that he had given her, and she opened the door and she got out and walked away.
Byron claimed that he had realized Justin was leaving Anastasia in a dangerous location, but stated that he didn't want to get in the middle of another couple's personal issues.
He said, "Kelly and I didn't say anything. It wasn't our fight."
Police wondered if Byron's girlfriend, 15-year-old Kelly Moffitt, would remember the night the same way. Detectives did everything they could to make sure that she and Byron didn't have a chance to compare notes. When police questioned Kelly, her story matched up perfectly with what her boyfriend had told investigators.
Kelly Moffitt.
She got out of the car, like the stoplight after the bridge.
She got out of the car.
Mm-hmm. And Justin and he's like, you know, quit being a baby. Just get back here and talk. You don't need to like storm off. And she was just like yelling like stuff back at him. So finally he's like, you know, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. So he's like, let's just go back to my condo and I'll call her from there.
And so you left her.
Yeah.
She told them the same exact story that Byron Case told.
Byron and Kelly's account of the argument matched the story Justin had told Anastasia's family. But Justin's friends added one very disturbing detail.
Byron and Kelly told investigators that Justin Bruton had bought a gun. It was a shotgun.
Both Byron and Kelly told police that Justin had bought the weapon just a few weeks before to use for target practice. Detectives were stunned. It was the same type of firearm that had been used to kill Anastasia. At that point, police zeroed in on Justin as the prime suspect.
He certainly was the main person of interest.
Had a lover's quarrel turned into a deadly confrontation later that night? Detectives were anxious to know what had happened after Justin dropped his friends off at their homes. And just hours after police interviewed Byron and Kelly, a deputy discovered Justin's car parked alongside a shed 30 minutes outside of Kansas City.
They walked around the side of the shed and they found Justin.
But Justin Bruton would never tell police what had happened that night.
He had killed himself.
And police weren't surprised by the method he used to commit suicide.
He had used a shotgun. He had obviously put it up to his face and had pulled a trigger.
At first, investigators saw Justin's suicide as an admission of guilt. It looked like he had gone out of his way to end his life in the same way that Anastasia had been murdered.
That natural inclination would have been that Justin killed Anastasia, felt bad about it, and then went and killed himself.
But almost immediately, questions about that conclusion began to surface. The shotgun he had used to commit suicide was not the same one that had killed his girlfriend. In fact, videotape from the gun store confirmed that Justin had purchased the second weapon after Anastasia's murder.
We found out that Justin had taken about 10 to 15 minutes, picked out a 12-gauge shotgun, ammunition, and purchased it and left.
Investigators were puzzled.
Why would you buy a different gun? Why would you get rid of the murder weapon you used on one person and then go buy something else to kill yourself? Most murder suicides, you don't kill somebody in place one, take a whole day, go find a different place, and then kill yourself.
Surprisingly, Anastasia's father also doubted that Justin was the killer.
I didn't believe it. It didn't answer enough questions. Why did he need to buy another gun? If he was going to end his life, he would have just write a note and say that, okay, you know, I can't handle the guilt that I feel. I don't want to turn myself in. I'm going to kill myself.
But if Justin Bruton wasn't the one to have killed Anastasia, then who had? Investigators believe there were two people that might know a lot more than they were saying. Over the next few months, police questioned Byron Case and Kelly Moffitt time and time again.
The whole story seems suspect. In order to believe their story, you would have to believe that this young girl who was going to walk home walked past two or three businesses that had phones, didn't use any of them, walked in the direction opposite of which her home was in, up where a Lincoln Cemetery was. There was no lights, no people. that she had been accosted by some unknown person who had no intention of robbing her, sexually assaulting her, but just wanted to shoot her and kill her. It just defied believability.
But the teenagers stuck to their original story.
Anastasia's friend, Danielle Fields.
Everybody that I know were absolutely convinced that Byron and Kelly both knew more than what they were telling anybody.
And that included Anastasia's father, Bob Witbolsfugen. He was certain that his daughter's death was not the result of a murder-suicide.
Anastasia's father, Bob Witbolsfugen.
Yes, there were arguments, but not like she came home with bruises on her or that they had been fighting and pushing her. I never heard anything like that. So I could never imagine that it had gotten to the level that they wanted to raise this to.
Bob became angry at investigators who seemed convinced that Justin was the killer.
I think anger would describe that, yeah, because I knew that it didn't answer my questions. Even amongst her own friends, the story didn't make any sense. I was pretty upset with the investigation for trying to write it off that way.
Anastasia's father believed that the murder-suicide conclusion was nothing more than a rush to judgment. Bob Witbolsfugen refused to allow the case to be closed. He tried to push the case forward by opening up his own investigation.
People who knew her wanted to say things. I wanted to go out and meet these people. I went out and investigated.
A reward was posted for information, and Bob spent countless hours retracing the routes Anastasia might have taken after she got out of Justin's car.
This is the only other place that Anastasia had been known to be seen that night. I thought she probably would have returned here.
Bob played out every scenario of what might have happened that night. But he never understood how his daughter could have wound up dead in a desolate cemetery.
I'd come here often, hoping to talk to somebody who had seen her that evening. And as the weeks slipped by, I worried. I could not do anything else.
Those weeks slowly turned into years, and the investigation stalled.
I think the police continued to try to investigate. They tried to interview other people, but it really didn't go very far. There was nothing left to look at. It was a situation where people either thought it was a murder-suicide and that Justin was at fault, or there were other people who thought there's just something more that happened here and we can't figure out what it is.
Despite the passage of time, Bob held out hope that his daughter's case would one day be solved.
I was kind of like a thorn under somebody's saddle that I would not let it go. It was not an answer that I could accept. And not if I can help it.
Anastasia's sister, Francesca Fitzner.
I think my whole family was nervous that the case might go unsolved. Not knowing for sure, like, what had happened. It was very troublesome.
More on The Case, the podcast, after this. Then, in September of the year 2000, there was a major break in the case.
Kelly Moffitt came forward.
Kelly Moffitt was the 15-year-old girl who had been in the car with Anastasia, Justin Bruton, and her boyfriend Byron Case on the night of the murder. She knew that telling the police a new story 3 years after the murder would seem suspicious, but she didn't care. Kelly Moffitt.
It just got to the point where I knew Her family deserved to know what happened.
Kelly was nervous. She was now facing the same detective she had been lying to since the early days of the investigation. Kelly Moffitt told police that carrying the dark secret of Anastasia's murder had sent her on a downward spiral of drug and alcohol abuse for more than 3 years. She now believed that the only way she could get her life back was to tell them what had really happened that night, even if it meant going to jail. Her disturbing account began when Justin Bruton and her boyfriend Byron Case picked her up after school.
Justin and Byron had been hanging out. They came and picked me up. Justin was talking about how much better his life would be if Anastasia was just gone. And I really didn't understand what they meant. And then they went to expound on that they were planning on killing her that night.
It was an alarming statement. But at the time, Kelly didn't think much of it.
Just everything about Byron was so over the top. And a lot of the stuff that he did was for shock value.
Kelly told police that Justin and her boyfriend Byron had always talked about doing crazy and dangerous things. She never believed they would actually kill Anastasia.
It seemed ridiculous. It was just like their sick fantasy world. They had had a lot of other plans to do stuff like that that had never happened. They'd talked about robbing a bank at one point. And instead, they got like 30 minutes out of town and got donuts and came home.
Kelly told police it never occurred to her to warn Anastasia of what had been said, even as she became an accomplice in the plot.
They were going to pick her up from a Dairy Queen in Independence where she lived.
In fact, Kelly called Anastasia to set it all up. She remembers what she told her friend on that fateful call.
The four of us were going to hang out and to let her know that we were on our way.
During the drive to Independence, nothing seemed out of the ordinary. And when the three friends arrived at Dairy Queen, they saw Anastasia waiting for them.
She got in the car and then we just started driving around. Justin was driving, Anastasia was in the side passenger seat, I was in the back passenger seat, and Byron was sitting in the back with me.
It was getting dark when Justin turned onto a quiet dirt road so that he and Anastasia could have a moment alone.
That ended up being Lincoln Cemetery. Justin and Anastasia got out of the car. Anastasia and Justin were kind of fighting.
The fight started to get loud, and Kelly could overhear what the couple was arguing about.
She was asking, you know, if he loved her anymore, or just things like that.
While Justin and Anastasia fought about their relationship in the cemetery, Kelly and Byron listened to music in the car. But then, Byron suddenly sprang into motion.
Byron went to get out of the car. That made me go, like, what is he doing?
Just seconds later, she heard the trunk open.
The trunk popped, and then he got the gun out.
Byron pulled out a large shotgun. Then Kelly heard Justin scream, followed by a deafening blast.
I heard the gun go off, and I saw her fall backwards. I mean, he shot her from really close range.
Kelly claims Anastasia never had time to react.
I don't think she even had time to register what was going on.
But Kelly realized exactly what was going on. Anastasia had just been murdered.
I felt like I was going to throw up. Immediately, I knew nothing was ever going to be the same again after that.
Byron jumped into the passenger seat and told Justin to get in the car. We have to go. Justin got in and immediately began to panic.
Justin was like, didn't you hear me telling you not to do it? He's like, at that point, it was too late. I already had the gun out. And he was basically bragging and laughing about it.
As Justin drove away from the crime scene, Kelly wondered how it was that her boyfriend had just committed a cold-blooded murder.
I couldn't wrap my head around the fact that Anastasia was actually dead, but it was obvious that she wasn't getting up or anything. It didn't even seem real.
Kelly was terrified and feared she was going to jail for what had just happened.
That was a main thing that influenced me in lying to the police, was that Byron just kept telling me, you're just as guilty as I am.
Byron then fabricated the story that he and Kelly would tell police for the next 3 years.
He said to say that they got into a fight and that when Justin stopped at an intersection, that she jumped out of the car.
Byron directed Justin to an industrial park where they got rid of the murder weapon. They then drove to Kelly's house, where Justin made his phone call to Anastasia's family.
He told him the story that Byron had come up with, and then I remember he was really, really shaken because he had talked to Anastasia's sister, and she's like, gee, thanks, Justin. Thanks a lot for possibly contributing to the demise of my sister, because she knew that that wasn't a good area. And I remember that Justin looked really sick about it.
When Kelly tried to tell detectives that she and Justin had been too scared not to follow Byron's plan, they were skeptical. Kelly still regrets not calling police on the night of the murder and telling them the truth about how Anastasia died.
Now, that's the biggest regret of my entire life. If I would have been older and not been so terrified of Byron, that I absolutely would have done that. But I just felt so trapped in the situation that I was in. I had no idea what to do.
Although Byron never directly threatened Kelly's life after the murder, he convinced her that the police would never believe her version of the story.
I knew that it would just be my word versus his.
And any hope Kelly had of Justin Bruton coming forward with her ended when he took his own life just hours later.
I think right after it happened, he'd made up his mind that he was going to kill himself. I was very, very sad that Justin was dead because I cared about him, but I also knew that it was just me and Byron left. Byron knew my family. He knew where my family lived.
According to Kelly, when Byron found out about Justin's suicide, his reaction was troubling.
He wasn't upset. I think he was relieved because I think that that was one less person that actually knew what happened. I think he kind of saw it as a good thing because now they're just going to think Justin did it.
Once Kelly finally came clean, she said she didn't care whether she was going to be charged as an accessory to the crime.
At least that would have been some type of closure, and at least her family would have known the truth.
Investigators carefully examined Kelly's statement line by line and concluded she was now telling the truth. Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Teresa Crayon.
When you listen to Kelly's whole story, it made sense. Kelly never saw a picture of the crime scene. She was never shown one. Yet she was able to describe exactly the position of Anastasia's body. And, you know, what was Kelly's motive to lie about this when she came forward?
After her interview with police, Kelly believed that she could put her horrifying memories behind her. But the prosecution still needed her help in getting Byron's confession.
We coordinated with the sheriff's department to put Kelly back in contact with Byron. They put a listening device on her home phone.
Investigators coached Kelly on what to say when she made the call to Byron.
I was going to tell him that the police wouldn't leave me alone and that I could not remember the exact story that we had called the police, and I needed him to go through it with me again.
When Kelly called Byron, her 21-year-old ex-boyfriend had moved back in with his parents.
Kelly Moffitt.
Two or three investigators have called me, and I don't know what to do. I don't remember the whole story, and I mean your information, please, because they are going to call me in. This is and we're both going to be. I hate to say this, but why did you have to kill her? Justin said for no reason, she said for no reason.
Despite Kelly's efforts, Byron never confessed. But for Assistant Prosecutor Teresa Crayon, his lack of a denial was just as critical. She called it a tacit admission of the crime.
A tacit admission is a failure of someone to respond to a statement that would naturally call for a response. For example, if someone were to accuse you of doing something terrible, like killing somebody, and you didn't do it, your natural response would be, I don't know what you're talking about, I didn't do that. And that's not what happened here.
On June 11th, 2001, Byron Case was arrested for first-degree murder. It was the moment Bob Whipple's Fugan had been waiting for. Although Bob didn't know Byron, what he had heard from others made him confident that Byron was capable of murder. Anastasia's father, Bob Whipple's Fugan.
I heard stories from the friends that said Byron had a very macabre approach to life. He even wondered openly about what it would be like to kill somebody.
But nothing he heard made it any easier for Bob to understand why Byron had murdered his daughter.
She went to school with Byron since eighth grade. I'm trying to imagine that she would have had friends like this. I mean, that's an ultimate betrayal.
And now, for Byron Case to face justice, a jury would have to believe Kelly Moffitt's story. Prosecutors prepared her for what she would most likely face when she took the stand.
She had lied. She was a drug addict. She had been kicked out of her house. She had been in counseling. You're going to be called all sorts of things. You're going to challenge everything. You've lied, and you've just got to own that. You've got to understand that people have to believe that you're not trying to make excuses for that. We were concerned about it, and that's why we took our time in charging it.
And Kelly Moffitt was concerned as well. Taking the stand was the most difficult thing she had ever done. She worried that if Byron got away with murder, he'd come after her next.
He didn't care that Justin was dead. He didn't care that he'd killed Anastasia.
But Kelly's emotional testimony sealed the fate of Byron Case. He was found guilty of Anastasia's murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Byron showed no emotion as the verdict was read. Anastasia's father believes his lack of reaction was proof of his guilt.
If you could give him any latitude for not wanting to disrupt his own trial, you would say after the verdict was pronounced, he may have been pretty upset. And I did not hear or see anything. After I've heard him deny it for 4 years, you're guilty. You know it.
Assistant Prosecutor Teresa Cran feels that this case was one of the most tragic ones she's ever worked on.
What a waste. What an absolute waste of life. This was a girl who loved Justin Bruton. She wanted to have a life with him. She was frustrated by his lack of commitment. She wanted to talk about the relationship. They get out of the car to do it, and what she's met with is someone she knew, someone she trusted, pulled a gun out, put it up to her face, and pulled the trigger. I mean, the last moments of her life must have just been awful.
Even though many lives were destroyed that senseless night, the prosecutor decided not to charge Kelly Moffitt with any crimes.
Although she doesn't condone Kelly's initial lies to police, she understands why she did it and feels Kelly has already been punished enough.
She was young, she was scared, and she was following the direction of people that clearly had their own interests in mind and not hers. I mean, it certainly was the wrong thing to do. We're coming from a 15-year-old's perspective. She's with people who are a lot older. She never thought it was going to happen. She was frightened and scared for her role in it, which Byron repeatedly reminded her of.
While the outcome was a relief, it did little to ease Kelly's conscience about what she had put Anastasia's family through.
I think about that every day. I've also thought, why didn't I say something in the car? Why didn't I warn her? Why did I even hang out with these people in the first place? She would still be alive. She'd be 35 today. Yeah, I've thought about that a lot.
Kelly says facing Anastasia's family for the first time since the murder was one of the hardest things she's ever done in her life.
That was really, really hard. How on earth would you tell someone that you were sorry that they're daughter got killed and that you didn't say anything. I can't even imagine having to go through that.
In the end, Anastasia's family was grateful for the answers Kelly had provided. Anastasia's father, Bob Wittbolsfugen.
The answers that she gave were the ones that were needed to give me that closure.
The guilty verdict had closed the most painful chapter of their lives, but it couldn't fill the void her violent death left behind. Anastasia's sister, Francesca Fitzner.
There's so many things that I've gotten to do that she'll never get to do. Get married and have kids and be with someone that wants to be with her and have that love returned, because she deserved that.
To keep Anastasia's legacy alive, her family has established a memorial website that displays her artwork and poetry. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.